Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, Tom Higgins is a legendary motorsports reporter. He's been covering auto racing for almost 60 years, starting in 1957. I hope he'll tell us about the race that he started on. And he's written a book about the glory days, that is the 50s and the 60s, called Racing in the Past, Tales from the Glory Days of Stock Car Racing. And some of that history took place right here in Orange County. But in any event, Tom, you've come to Chapel Hill. You said it's the first time in a while.
First time in quite a few years, correct.
How can a newspaper man, how can a journalist stay away from Chapel Hill for so long? I thought you had to come back here and bow down at the Mecca.
I should find that statue of Charlie Justice and go down there and kneel in reverence, because he was my boyhood hero, and I was lucky enough to meet him and became friends with him. And he teased me pretty often each time we'd meet about being from Burnsville.
Well, you grew up in the mountains, and of course, a lot of our folks grew up in the mountains as well. The reason I touched on the journalism aspect is that some of your younger colleagues on the sports side put you in the pantheon of great storytellers and great writers, and that's why we're one of the reasons why we're so happy to have you back in Chapel Hill.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate their comments and the respect they've shown me.
Well, we got my buddy P.H. Craig sitting in with me, but he will tell you that Chapel Hill, it's not the greatest sports car fan town. Politically, we're sort of out of sync with much of the rest of the state, and I would say with many of the sports car, the NASCAR fans, and to a certain extent the drivers as well. But you make a statement like that, and then somebody will raise their hand and say, you know, man, I might not agree with Petty politically, but I sure did like the way he raced.
You'd be surprised where you can find NASCAR fans. Junior Johnson tells a story that he and his family always went to New York at Christmas when the kids were younger. And he would take his wife Lisa shopping. And he was sitting in a elegant store up there, women's store, while she shopped. And he was on a comfortable sofa waiting on her. And he said this well-dressed, very, very sophisticated lady came by. And she did a double take and came back to him and said, "Excuse me, sir, aren't you Junior Johnson?"
Is that right?
He was blown away by that.
Then did he fess up?
Oh, yes. Yeah. He's proud of it. Yeah, he's tickled to be recognized.
Well, in writing about it, you know who writes you back and is interested in the stories about NASCAR. And so did you find out, that the idea of Joe Sixpack coming and bringing his wife and sitting there drinking beer and having a good time, and I don't want to call them,
blue-collar fans.
Blue-collar, yeah. But there are others.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I thought Bruton Smith was nuts when he built the suites, VIP suites at Charlotte. And my goodness, now you got bank presidents and corporate CEOs avidly watching the races from those suites, and the other tracks have built them too.
Well, you've been covering it, I guess, for 57 almost 58 years. Tell us about the first race you covered and how it happened up in the tell us about a little bit about you growing up, and then how you happened to be in the mountains to see that first race.
I had always wanted to be a professional baseball player, but Coach Chick Martin at Brevard College convinced me that I could never solve the aerodynamics of curveball, and he encouraged me to become a sports writer. He sensed I might have a talent for it. And he helped, through Bob Terrell, at the great sports editor at the Asheville Citizen Times, helped me get a summer job at the weekly Canton Enterprise. I covered their fast pitch softball team, which was a world-class team. They played the world champion Clearwater, Florida Bombers, Ray Bestos from Connecticut. So I went over there.
This would have been in about 1957,
summer of 57. I just finished Brevard College, 2 years, junior college. And so I went over there to Canton to work, and in August, late August, the softball season was over. And I'd planned to go to Pfeiffer to play basketball, as I'd played at Brevard. And during one of those really important softball games against Clearwater, I'd met Al Giamatti from the Asheville Times, quite a colorful character. And darn if he didn't call and offer me a job for a few months. And so I took it.
And what did he say? How did he describe the job? Come write sports
two
for me.
Two-man sports staff. I understand you're not going back to school until after Christmas. I hadn't graduated at Brevard. I'd become enthralled by fetching co-ed from Chattanooga. And I didn't graduate, so I wasn't going to be eligible at Pfeiffer. And he said, come work for me until I can hire someone permanently. So I went over to the Asheville Times and Afternoon Daily, and I think the second day there, I knew I wasn't going back to school. I'd forgotten Pfeiffer. I heard the clacking of those teletype machines and saw the breaking news, and I said, this is for me. But anyway, there was a race at Asheville Weaville Speedway, half-mile track, scheduled shortly after I got to Asheville.
It's hard for us now used to the Charlotte Motor Speedway and the big Daytona and the big races, and even a lot of people here have forgotten, you know, the speedway that we – or the racetrack that we had here. But I think you said that this racetrack was built, you know, between third base and
– No, that was McCormick Field.
Oh, okay.
The Asheville Weaville Speedway was built on top of a hill out near Flat Creek, which was a rural community.
So it had a longer –
Yeah, and bigger track in McCormick Field. And Al Giamatti ordered me to go over there and cover the race, and I said, oh, no, I don't care anything about racing. I've never seen one. He said, well, you're going to learn on the job. Go cover the race. Well, there was no choice but to do it. And I went over there on race day and was completely lost and scared to death. And I wandered around, and I saw a rickety frame tower on the infield side of the start-finish line. And I climbed that tower, and there were two men on top of it, slacks and sports shirts, but they had helmets curled under their arms. And I said, they must be drivers. And that's what drivers wore in races in those days. And they looked familiar, and I recognized them as Curtis Turner and Joe Weatherly. And they were passing a bottle of Jim Beam back and forth just for the race. And they didn't have rides that day, but it didn't matter. If they'd gotten one, they were still drinking the Jim Beam. And I said, dang, this is a hairy-chested sport. I think I'm going to like this. And I met Richard Petty that day. He's the same age as me. He was working in his father Lee's pit crew. And I really liked him, and I liked his daddy. And so I was just enthralled by it all. And
well, how'd you write the story? Well, what happened that day? Was there anything worth writing about?
Yeah, Lee Petty won the pole and the race, and I couldn't believe cars could go that fast. I think they were going 89, 90 miles an hour. I couldn't believe the cars would go that fast, and that if they could, that there were men crazy enough to drive them.
Well, how'd you write it up? Somebody had to help you. You had to go around and ask people what was happening, I guess, didn't you?
Yeah, but I just went back and wrote that it was thrilling beyond anything I'd comprehended, and that the noise and the action and the color was just something not to be missed, really.
So you, from that first race, you were taken. You were ready to write about stock car racing for the next 57 or 58 years.
I didn't know it was going to be that long. I didn't think I would live that long, but I knew I was going to cover it as long as I could, and that the sports editors would assign me to do it.
We're visiting with Tom Higgins, who's, as you just heard, has been writing sports and primarily stock car racing for the last 57 plus years. He's going to tell us some more stories after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Tom Higgins. Tom is the author of a new book called Racing Into the Past, Tales from the Glory Days of Stock Car Racing. It's the first in a series of planned books, and he's in this one writing about the 50s and the 60s. And he just told us about his first race coverage up in Asheville. And we learned that Lee Petty won the race. Richard Petty was on the crew. So our buddy PH asked a question I would have never thought to ask, which was, were the Petties really bootleggers? And what was your answer? Can you
not on the scale of Junior Johnson and some of the others, but just Richard did casually mention about a year ago in an event down at the NASCAR Hall of Fame in Charlotte, there's Daddy Hall Liquor. Didn't surprise me at all, because most of them did. Tim Flock was a notorious moonshine hauler down in Georgia. So was his brother Fonty.
Did you know
quite a few of the promoters dealt in moonshine? Enoch Staley at North Wilkesboro, Clay Earls at Martinsville, Joe Littlejohn down at Spartanburg, on and on and on.
Well, somebody told me that this is with respect to our Orange County Speedway, that the folks at North Wilkesboro were able to invest or had an incentive
to invest.
Yeah,
Enoch Staley ran Orange County.
And that part of the reason was that they needed a place to put their money to sort of conceal their ill-gained.
I think that's called laundering, D.G.
I should have remembered that word, but I'm getting old. I have to go 20 words to describe. So, but that it was a part and parcel of the business. You, and a PH knows this story, but you tell the story about Junior Johnson's, PH, you told me he never got caught hauling, but you write a story about he got caught making the liquor. Will you tell that story?
Junior came in from a race in Pennsylvania. NASCAR ran 50, 60 races.
What year would this have been?
Late 50s. Uh-huh. And they ran 50, 60 races back in that time period. And they'd been on what they call their northern swing, small tracks in the north. And he came in from a race, got in the middle of the night, and found that his father was sick. And Junior's daddy was kingpin of the moonshiners in Wilkes County. And Mr. Johnson said, "Junior, I just feel terrible." Said, "Would you go like to number 13 steel?" They always
the number 13 steel.
Number 13
they had.
Steel.
I mean,
they had maybe 1,000 steel.
No, come on.
Yeah.
They farmed it out. They had people making liquor for them. It was a heck of an operation. And they lit them in the dead of night so the revenues wouldn't see the smoke. There was no smoke once they got the coke going. They used coke.
So when you first light it up, there's going to be a lot of smoke. Then it'll calm down and just do on the coals.
So they lit them in the middle of the night so there would be no smoke tip off the revenuers. So Junior, He said, I always did what my daddy told me, and he went to like to steal. Well, they'd found it and staked it out. And
The revenuers. Or the
revenuers, yeah. And he sensed it too late. He threw a shovel full of coal, of coke, at one of them and took off running. And he had left a gate and a fence open in case he had to run. And he knew if he hit that gate that they would the revenuers would probably get hooked up in the barbed wire and you'd get away. Well, he missed the gate, and they were on top of him. And
so what happened?
Charged him. And
did he have to go to jail?
Yes. He went before the hanging judge of Moonshiners, federal judge Johnson V. Hayes, and he had been waiting to see Junior on charges he could not get out of, and he gave him a year and a day, federal prison in Chillicothe, Ohio. He served 11 months and 3 days and was released.
How about his daddy?
His daddy served years and years in the federal prison in Atlanta.
How did they get along, or how did Junior Johnson get along in the prison?
He did fine. Junior knew about running farm equipment. My God, he had been raising acres and acres of corn to make liquor with, and he knew how to maintain tractors and
all
that.
He's a valuable commodity.
They put Junior in charge of the prison farm, and he actually became pretty good friends with the warden and some of the guards, and they later came to see him race.
Is that right? Well, I want to we'll come back to you can't get away from Junior Johnson.
No. But incredible life. I maintain he's probably lived the most unbelievable life of any North Carolinian.
I want you you told us about your entry into the sports writing or the writing about the stock car racing world. And that was up in Asheville. You were comfortable. You had your friends. What was your first big race?
The 1958 Southern 500 at Darlington. And I was unprepared for it. I hadn't seen nothing yet, as the old saying goes. Rode through the night to get down there, and three friends went with me in a new, brand new pink and white Edsel.
An Edsel, you're driving it.
Right.
A brand new one. How'd you get it? I mean, unless the sports writing business was more remunerative.
No. A friend went with me who was owned a timber company in Yangtze County, and it was his. He's a pretty well off guy. And one of the guys brought along some moonshine, and yes, we partake of it.
So y'all were driving an Edsel down from the mountains, drinking moonshine
right
on the way.
Right. And we got there at sunup, and
I want you. You know, you and I both lived in Charlotte for a while. I think you made a stop in Charlotte for some hamburgers.
We stopped at the White Castle. First time I ever ate at one of them. I'll never forget it. In the middle of the night on the way to Darlington, I don't know whether it's because of the moonshine or not, but we got lost several times on the way to Darlington. We didn't get there till daylight. And
you got there the morning of the race.
Right.
And so what do you do when you're...
Well, I was going to try to take a nap, but there was so much action and everything going on. The high school bands were marching in, playing, and a humongous crowd. And they announced that the Grand Marshal was going to go by, and I said, I got to see him. It was James Arness of Gunsmoke.
Oh, boy.
Matt Dillon himself. And
at the height, man, I mean, this is 57, 58?
58.
So he's...
This is the big time. So I go down to the press box to go in. And it's an open-air press box that hung low over the first turn. It hung right over the railing. And the only safety feature it had separating the press from cars and flying parts was rusted chicken wire. And as dangerous could be. And I get to the top flight of the stairs, and a Boy Scout hands me a pair of goggles. I said, dang, that's nice. Come down here to race, and they give me a nice pair of goggles. I go in and sit down on the front row of the press box, and I hear all these people laughing. And I turned around, and it's the other members of the press corps, and they're as far back in this press box as they can get. I said, I'm sitting on the front row. And about 10 laps into the race, I saw that I'd made a big mistake.
What was your mistake? I
was covered in rubber dust and asphalt dust from the track.
So you really had a trackside seat.
Oh, yeah. And I looked around behind me, and all those guys had their goggles on. Their faces were covered in it, too, and their eyes were white. It looked like a group of minstrels from an old Al Jolson show. And finally, one of the men motioned to me, to the greenhorn, to come up, and he would make room for me to sit down with him. And it turned out to be Wilton Garrison, the sports editor of The Observer, and who would have known 6 years later I would be working with him.
Well, so it is who you know and how you, if you're out and about and meet people.
He was a gentleman. He got me out of that dust.
Do you remember, was the race interesting at all?
Oh, for God's sakes. It was over 100 degrees that day, and NASCAR still used treaded tires, and the track temperature probably got to 155 or 60, and they were blowing tires so fast it sounded like cannon fire. And three cars went out of the track, tore down the rail right in front of the press box, just beyond the press box in the first turn. They took out 200 feet of rail. Eddie Gray from California went out. Eddie Pagan from California went out. And Jack Smith, Cracker Jack Smith, a driving champion, went out. He was the last three to go out. And the rail was gone. They couldn't get it back. They couldn't get support hose back, posts back in. And never happened today. They had steel rails then. And they kept running the race. Today it would have been red flag and declared a race. But they kept running. They told the drivers to go low and slow through the first turn. And all of them did except one. And that was Fireball Roberts, who maintained the same smooth, steady pace. And he won the race by 5 laps. And,
oh, my golly.
It took me a while to believe what I'd really seen. It was like something that they would have imagined in the movies.
Well, what was the, as you were trying to size it up, as you wrote the story, what was the appeal to the people that you were writing for and to the people who saw the race? Was it the dirt and the danger and the, or that they love Fireball, or what was the?
Oh, God, they love Fireball. Yeah, absolutely. They loved Fireball like they loved Richard Petty and Dale Earnhardt later on. But it was the cast of characters, the color, the action. It was just it was enthralling. I was blown away.
Well, we're visiting with Tom Higgins, who's the author of a new book, Racing Into the Past, Tales from the Glory Days of Stock Car Racing. He's telling us some of those tales. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Tom Higgins. He's the dean of the sports car racing writers, having done it for almost 58 years. And Tom, I mean, we haven't got time for you to tell us the stories that you got in the book. And you, I love the way that you get to the heart of the story real quick, so that the book is not interesting, but it's I don't want to say an easy read, but it's an interesting read. I got interested in one of your stories that had to do with the mechanics. And this is down in Florida. And a guy who hadn't been involved in sports, in stock car racing very much, all of a sudden got the urge to do it, and he tried to persuade somebody to work on the engines, on the motor. Do you remember that story?
I can't recall that.
Can't you? I think he was at Daytona, and there was maybe Mr. Fox.
That was the story of the 1960 Daytona 500.
Yeah.
The owner of the Daytona Beach Kennel Club decided 2 weeks before the race he wanted a car in the Daytona 500. So Ray Fox was a well-known crew chief, car builder, race car builder. He called him, said, I want you to build me a car for the race.
Tom, maybe some of our listeners don't understand, you know, exactly how it worked, because we think of stock car as coming off the lot. But you could, there were certain things you could do to the engine. And if you're rebuilding
then,
the car.
They got the cars out of the showroom, but they had to modify them and put the safety features in, the roll bars and all that. But
they could also make the engine faster.
Yeah, right. Yeah, they could soup up the engine.
So this is what he was talking about, mainly getting the car ready, doing the safety features. Yeah. But mainly he wanted to get the car fast. But
yeah.
How did he?
Couldn't be done in 2 weeks at that time. And he told him it couldn't be done. He said, what do you charge for building a car, getting a car ready? And he told him, he said, well, I'll double that. And Ray said, I haven't got a driver, but I'll see if I can get one. I'll call Junior Johnson. And he called Junior, and Junior agreed to go. He didn't have a ride.
He didn't have a ride in racing talk. That means
for that particular race.
That means he hadn't arranged or nobody had hired him drive their
for
car.
For the 1960 Daytona 500, yeah.
I don't want to get too far off, but it seems unusual that nobody would have made a deal with Junior Johnson.
It does seem very unusual, but he was free. He was available.
So this guy who decides 2 weeks before the race,
2 weeks,
he's going to have a car, he not only gets the best guy to fix the car, but he gets maybe arguably
one
the best driver.
One of the star drivers, right.
All right. So how did
they go down there and expectedly the car was slow. They'd worked day and night to get it ready, but it was slow, mainly compared to a fleet of factory Pontiacs backed by Detroit.
So the Pontiacs are right at this moment and at that are the fast cars. What kind of car was this?
Chevelle. Chevrolet Chevelle.
Okay.
And they just couldn't get it any faster. Junior was at times 30 miles an hour slower in practice than the Pontiacs. And
why would Junior agree to take a car that's so slow?
Well, he was going to go home. He told Ray, I can't abide this. I'm going home. And Ray said, wait one more day and let us work on it. We'll see if we can come up some more speed. In other words, they're going to see how much cheating they could get away with on the engine.
What would cheating be? I mean, because if you're redoing the engine,
there's any number.
There's just a whole bunch of rules that govern what you can.
A whole bunch of ways they could have tried to skirt it. But so Junior stuck around through his friendship with Ray for one more day. And they were practicing, and he said, I'm going to see if I can keep up with Cotton Owens, who was driving one of the factory Pontiacs. And he fell in behind Cotton Owens right on his bumper, and lo and behold, he did keep up with him.
And why? How could he keep up with him if he's 30?
The aerodynamic draft.
So he learned
Junior
about...
Junior discovered the aerodynamic draft.
The time in that race is when he... learned he could keep up with a 30 mile per hour faster
that
car by riding in the
slipstream. Right. Well. That was when the phenomenon of drafting came into being was in that race.
Well, if you're drafting, you can't pass the guy.
Yeah, you can because it's got a slipstream effect. You pull out, and it just catapults you right by it. and that was called Slingshot Pass. Mm-hmm. And so Junior stayed and ran the race, but he was still getting beat by a Pontiac driven by Bobby Johns with just a few laps left to go. They were running 1-2. And then for some unknown reason, in the second turn at Daytona International Speedway, the back window popped out of John's car.
The leading car.
Right. And that upset the handling on it, and he spun out. Well, Junior shot into the lead and won the race in that underdog car that had been put together in 2 weeks.
That is incredible. For me, that was an incredible story. And did it change Junior's method of racing otherwise?
Well, it changed it for everybody because all the other drivers they picked up on the drafting right quick. And that became a staple of racing at big tracks that continues to this day. Of course, now they run in such humongous packs rather than getting strung out. But it brought a new exciting dimension to racing on those big tracks.
Well, we're visiting with Tom Higgins. We're talking about his book, Racing Into the Past. We're talking about some of the stories from the 50s and 60s that he covers in his book. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I'm visiting with Tom Higgins, talking about stories from the past of the glory days of stock car racing. And he's got a new book that, if you join us late and you like these stories, you can read what we've talked about and more. Tom, they're good stories. If the one that I'd like for you to talk about is the Charlotte Motor Speedway. You said you weren't there when there was a confrontation about construction, but the story of how that racetrack got built is almost as good as some of the stories of the races that have been there.
That's true. There were two or three different groups wanting to build a speedway at Charlotte, a major speedway, and Curtis Turner headed one group, and they were going to build out near Pineville, and Bruton Smith headed the other group. Are the most legitimate groups, and they were going to build out near Concord, and neither of them was getting anywhere, so they decided to consolidate. And Bruton and Curtis didn't like each other very much, but for business purposes, they went into business together and started on the speedway. And what they didn't realize was right under the soil out there was this nothing but solid rock. And it delayed construction for week upon week. And finally they postponed the race two or three different times, and they finally ran it in mid to late June rather than on Memorial Day weekend. And they had hurriedly put the asphalt down, and it wasn't ready. It hadn't cured, as they say, and it started coming apart. And they put the grills on, put cages, grill-like cages in front of the radiators to keep flying parts from hitting them. They had them in front of the windshields to keep them from hitting them. They look like tanks. And, of course, there are cars hitting these potholes and blowing tires and wreck after wreck after wreck. And what they hadn't thought of was building a grill around the fuel tank to protect it. And Jack Smith, who had gone out of the track at Darlington, as I mentioned earlier, had built a 7-lap lead. And all of a sudden, a sharp piece of asphalt came up and punctured the fuel tank. and they tried every way on earth to get it plugged up. They used octagon soap, they used bubble gum, they used rags, everything, all to no avail. And as the gas leaked out, a guy named Joe Lee Johnson, no relation to Junior, kept gaining on him, and Jack Smith finally had to park, and Joe Lee Johnson won the only race of his career. That was a pretty ignominious start for Charlotte Motor Speedway.
Well, it marks, at least in North Carolina, the for me, a sort of a milepost in terms of the transition of the racing community from, I don't want to call them local speedways, but I remember the old one in Charlotte up near where the Southern Fairgrounds was and where a decrepit shopping center is
to
now.
To say they were rustic is an understatement. Asheville-Weaverville, the facilities up there, at least in the early years, were two military-type latrines dug out in the woods, and women took one path and men took another one.
Well, it's amazing. There are ups and downs to the success of NASCAR, and I wonder how you feel about your friends with the Frances, and so I'm not asking you to speak bad, but there is an upside and a downside to this modernization of the racing world. And for instance, here in Orange County, we don't have a speedway anymore. I think about the people in Rockingham and North Wilkesboro. Has this been good? Have these changes been good for racing and for the people who participate in the racing business?
I can understand NASCAR's wanting to go national, making it more of a national sport, in deference to their corporate sponsors. They certainly needed presence on the West Coast, California, in the Southwest, Phoenix, and in the Midwest, in Chicago, and in the Northeast, at New Hampshire. But they alienated a lot of fans when they closed these historic tracks, especially North Wilkesboro and Rockingham, and most of all when they moved the Southern 500 from the traditional Labor Day date to a track in California. That was, I couldn't believe it, still don't believe it. And now, after all these years, they realize their mistake, and they're bringing the Southern 500 back to Darlington on Labor Day, which is where it should have been all along.
That would be next year, or that would be
yes, 2015.
From now on,
2015. Yeah, they'll never move it again.
Well, that's great. Well, I should have asked you instead of getting you to talk about my favorite stories. What in your book? What is the favorite story that we haven't covered yet?
Well, I like all of them, but two or three favorites, I guess, are the most colorful fight in NASCAR history, at least in my estimation.
Tell us that story real quick.
Well, it was Tiny Lund and Lee Petty were having a feud, probably over money. Tiny had driven some for the Petties, and there was some kind of dispute, falling out, hard feelings.
Tiny Lund, it wasn't that he was tiny.
Oh, Lord, no, that was a misnomer. Tiny Lund was 6'6", probably 6'7", and weighed about 280 pounds, so he was not tiny.
So he and Lee are getting into a scrap.
Yeah, they were introducing the drivers at the Greensboro Fairgrounds for a race there. And they had a flatbed trailer truck as a stage. And Lee and Tiny happened to pass on the stage after being introduced. And one of them said something to the other one. And next thing you know, fists are flying. And Tiny, being so big, and Lee was tall, but he was wiry, Tiny's beating the devil out of him. So Richard and Maurice were teenagers. They go rushing to the rescue of their daddy. He's beaten the devil out of all three of them. The late Tim Flock told me it looked like minnows bouncing off a battleship. And so to rescue her family, Mrs. Petty, Lee's wife, Richard Murray's mama, she goes rushing onto the stage and starts flailing Tiny in the head with her purse, pocketbook. And the drivers who remember it fall down laughing when they tell about it. She was raising pump nuts on Tiny's head, and the purse was such a weapon that it broke up the fight. And the reason it was a weapon, Mrs. Petty had a 38 pistol.
38. Well, this story goes on a little bit, but that's the main point. And I've run out of time. Tom Higgins, these stories are so great. Thanks for collecting them and putting them in your book, Racing Into the Past. And thanks for taking time to come visit with us in Chapel Hill.
Sure, thanks. Been my pleasure, DG.
Thanks to you for listening. It's DG Martin, Who's Talking. I'll be back here before you know it.